This is ensemble member James Vincent Meredith, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Theatre Company podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here. It's a really exciting event. My name is Jacob Padrone. I'm the associate producer here at Steppenwolf Theatre Company, and it's my pleasure to welcome Philip Dawkins in conversation with Donald Margulies. So, take it away, gentlemen. Thank you.
All right. So, this is very exciting. Donald and I had a chance to meet earlier, about a month ago, I think, and talk things out, and it was so enjoyable, we thought we'd do it in front of you. I would just like to start out, I think we have so many people here interested in you and interested in writing and theater in general, and I'm interested to know, how did you get into this? How did you get into writing?
Well, you know, it's a curious thing, Philip. I grew up in Brooklyn. My parents were not theater people. They were not intellectuals. My father sold wallpaper. My mother was pretty much a housewife, you know, so we were really lived in very modest circumstances. However, my parents were of the generation that revered theater, Broadway theater. And from the earliest age, my parents schlepped me and my brother into Manhattan from Coney Island to see Broadway shows, pretty much Broadway musicals. So I had early exposure to theater, although it wasn't what I pursued as a kid in school. I could also draw very well. Well, very well for a 5-year-old. I could draw very well as a 10-year-old, too. And because I had this ability and this facility for drawing, it pretty much defined who I was academically. I was the class artist. So even though I had some interest in writing, the artwork was much more readily demonstrated, and I got a lot of support doing that. Then when it came time for me to go to college, because I come from a lower middle class household, I was given a partial scholarship to Pratt Institute, which was an art school in Brooklyn. So I rather wretchedly commuted from home in Coney Island to Pratt Institute. I did that for a year and a half where I was an art student. I was a graphic arts major at Pratt. And then I became very restless there because I found that I was interested in reading and writing, and a trade school, which is essentially what Pratt was at the time, couldn't provide me with any outlet. There were no mentors, there were no courses. And around this time, SUNY Purchase, the State University New York College at Purchase, New York, was just getting started in Westchester. And it was an arts school, but there was a focus on the humanities. So in other words, there was a place for guys like me there where I could continue to be a visual artist, which is what I did. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I could branch out and take political science and literature and playwriting. And I began taking playwriting with a critic named Julius Novick, who at that time was writing for the Village Voice. And I introduced myself to him one day as a visual arts major, and I said, would you sponsor me in a playwriting tutorial? And he said, have you ever written a play before? And I said, no. He said, I'd be delighted to sponsor you. And really, it was one of those rare and precious moments where I ran into I encountered a mentor who identified talent, told me that I was good, and told me that I should take it seriously and stick with it. And that really was a life-changing experience for me. I started writing plays when I was an art student.
That's great. That's really interesting to hear that you started out as a visual artist, because so many of the protagonists and characters in a lot of your plays are either visual artists, like photographers like Sarah in Time Stand Still,
right,
or Jonathan in Sight Unseen, or writers.
True.
And it seems to me that you've identified this very strong correlation between visual art, and specifically photography, and storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that's true. I wonder if you do see a correlation there. And I would like to hear you talk about that.
Well, you know, I think, you know, I'm often asked about whether, because of my background in visual art, if I see my plays in a different way than I think maybe some other writers might. And you know, I think that I do visualize them. I do have sort of an abstract idea of what people look like on the stage, what configurations they might take on the stage. But in terms of the vocation of my characters, they are all variations of the artist and the artist's relationship to the world. Mm. So some of my earlier plays might be about the, well, in The Loman Family Picnic, my alter ego is an 11-year-old named Mitchell.
Who writes a musical.
Who writes a musical comedy version of Death of a Salesman called Willie.
Yeah, which I would totally see, by the way.
Which I totally did.
Awesome, good.
At the age of 11. That's probably the most autobiographical thing I've ever written about. But Mitchell is one of the earlier young artists that I've drawn from during the course of my oeuvre. But I am often interested in the role of the artist, and you can define the artist as the short story writer, the photographer, the figurative painter, whatever. Mm-hmm. Because I think it comes from, well, now I'm sounding like I'm on the couch, but I don't mean to. But I think, you know, being a survivor of a certain kind of upbringing, and I think we all have survived our own respective upbringings, mm-hmm. That there's a certain amount of survivor guilt that comes with surviving. And I think that I was always that 11-year-old kid who observed and who sort of took in everything and tried to make sense of things. So in that sense, I was a precocious kid artist. But I think that that impulse has stayed with me throughout my body of work.
I know Sarah in Time Stand Still has a lot of issues and battle scars, both literal and physical, from her correspondence. Mm-hmm. And I think Robert Fisk in The Independent brought up that the people who really need the help, you know, dealing with their scars are still over there without the opportunity to get out. Mm-hmm. And why is it we don't romanticize them, but we do romanticize the people who go over and take pictures of them? And I think that's something that you address in your play.
Well, I think to a certain extent I do. But I think the reason why, and this, I haven't really thought about this particular thing, mm-hmm. but I think one of the reasons why the role of the journalist is so much a part of the conversation now. You know, so sadly, I think the play is perhaps more timely than it was, you know, even a couple of months ago, mm-hmm. because it's so much a part of our consciousness now. When these people are supposed to be neutral, they're supposed to be sort of hermetically sealed in a bubble, observing these things. And I think when that bubble is pierced and penetrated, and deaths result. I think the rules are different for them. Mm. Because these are people who are our surrogates, who are in these settings. They're not of the place that they are chronicling. They are there for us, for the world, to capture these moments. So then when they themselves are victimized, I do think that it goes against the natural order of this concept of chronicling.
Yeah, and you, I think you address that really well in Time Stand Still with the character of Mandy, mm-hmm. Who I told you before I adore. I really identify with her heart, and she brings up that issue of watching a nature program and watching an animal dying and not one. You know, wondering why don't they just step in and do something? And I have to tell you, that's probably supposed to meant to be simple, but I feel that way all the time. I can't watch nature programs because I'm like, save that elephant.
Right. No, I know.
Because save that elephant. Yeah. And you know, and my dad would tell me, it's like, well, you know, you're not supposed to intervene with nature. And I'm like, when did people become not nature? Like we're intervening. Let's do something while we're there. And mm-hmm. Sarah would say,
yeah.
You know, quite the opposite, right? It's our job to document,
right,
so that people know about the elephant, right?
Right.
And then on a larger scale about human atrocities, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, you know, I think this issue of mm-hmm. sort of crossing the line, let's call it crossing the line, to speak in more broad terms, in relation to the other artistic protagonists that I've written about, is that all of those artists cross the line in a way.
Yeah.
And Sarah's another aspect of that. And I think that's part of my fascination with the role of the artist, where we're all cannibals. We all take things from experience and observation and stories people have told us and things that we have witnessed, we have taken all of these things and we put it through the Cuisinart and we turn it into art. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, all of these lines in the sand get crossed in one form or another when the artist is at work.
Do you think that that is vital to the role of drama, that a line has to be crossed? Would you say that that's...
I think that's well put. I think that when the line is crossed is when you have conflict. Mm-hmm. Until that line is crossed, you don't. You may have a certain tension.
Yeah.
But you don't yet have that conflict. You don't have that violation. But then something's got to be pierced.
That's really interesting.
And then when that happens, that's when you actually get fireworks.
Right. Well, and in Time Stands Still, the line has been crossed almost like pre-show, right? They come home, one of many lines mm-hmm. that gets crossed. The physical danger has happened before the start of the play.
Right.
Right, and then they've brought this home. So they've really got this war going on at home based on what they've experienced out there.
Right.
And it left me wondering, you know, is it possible to be fully aware of everything that's going on in the world and be happy? Or is it negligent or mm-hmm. or simple to be happy when we know that all this is going on and maybe there's nothing we can do about it? Like, what do we do with these images?
Right.
These
you
horrible
sound like Mandy now.
I do. I love her. I think she's wonderful. But what do you...
I don't know.
Yeah.
The questions that you are asking are the questions I want audiences to ask when seeing them. I don't have the answers. Sarah doesn't have the answer. But you know, for me, one of the pleasures of writing is to surprise people, and for me, Mandy is one of those surprises. Mm-hmm. We think we have her pegged. Sarah thinks she has her pegged, mm-hmm. and she turns out to be much more formidable and much more attuned to the world mm-hmm. than anyone would give her credit for, you know, upon presentation. You know,
right.
And I like that in people, and I like that in characters.
Yeah. You often have a character in your plays who we think we know right out of the gate who they are, and then somewhere around middle of Act Two, we get smacked in the face in a way that is entirely delightful and line-crossing, I think. And I think that's something you do very well, and it was particularly enjoyable to watch Mandy's journey, I think, mm-hmm. for me.
Yeah, I love that character.
Yeah.
I really do love her.
Really cool. So something that switching gears entirely, something that has leapt out to me both in Time Stands Still and in a lot of your work is the persistence of all of these relationships, romantic or not, that are not technically marriages. And it's actually brought up in Time Stands Still when Mandy says, "You guys have a great marriage." She says, "Oh, we're not legally married."
Right.
Because they were too busy saving the world. Mm-hmm. And then she says, mm-hmm. "I'm too busy saving the world," which is also why I'm not married. But I think about in every single one of your plays, including Shipwrecked, which I would classify as a family-appropriate play. There's this unauthorized marriage where the guy just decides he's married to this islander, and so they are. And I look at how many non-traditional marriages you have mm-hmm. in your plays, and I wonder, how would you define a marriage, both mm-hmm. as a playwright, as a husband, and as a father?
Wow. You know, in a way, for me, one of the surprises that I experienced writing Time Stands Still was that it became a marriage play.
Yeah.
I didn't expect it to be that, and I didn't set out to write that. But for me, the journey, if you will, that Sarah and James experience in this is an allegory of marriage. You know, it's about people who, and this is, now I'm getting to the definition part.
Yeah.
But people who are drawn together because of shared passions, shared worldview, shared politics. And of course, there's attraction and you know, mm-hmm. all of those other things as well. But I think that sort of the foundation of any good functioning as opposed to dysfunctioning relationship, all of those things exist, I believe. It's when the values begin to change and one member of the team becomes restless or the other one becomes too comfortable, mm-hmm. that things begin to shift. There are those, you know, when I was describing Dinner with Friends years ago when I first read it, I said that it's all of these domestic seismic shifts, you know, that happen around the kitchen table. But they're minute, but they're huge. Mm-hmm. They're minutiae, but they really do have these incredible aftershocks. So I do think, you know, for James and Sarah, who begin the play not married to each other, although they have been, as James says, you know, after a couple has been through what we've been through, let's call this what it is, a marriage, I think he's right. You know, they have gone through the wars, literally. And figuratively, I think all of us who go through rich, rewarding, tragic lives experience the same kind of battleground. You know, but for them, the stakes are enormous. And that's what makes a play, I think.
In terms of balancing a family as mm-hmm. a writer for yourself, mm-hmm. how have you benefited from being a husband or being a father, or both, mm-hmm. in your writing and in your career? How has it informed your work? Mm-hmm. And also, how has it been difficult?
Well, I'm very fortunate that I have a strong marriage to a very smart, funny, complicated woman like all of the women I write.
Awesome.
So my wife is, she's a superb muse, and she understands what it is to live with a writer. So that in the gestation days of Dinner with Friends, if we had a particularly piquant argument, when the smoke cleared, I would say, can I use that? And she said, yeah, use it. But again, being given permission to tap into those moments, you know, is a tremendous gift that my wife gave me, and continues to mm-hmm. give me. I don't show my wife my work while I'm working on it, incidentally. I usually invite her to the first reading of something. Because I find that I bruise very easily when I'm working on something. And if I expose something to her, you know, more than almost anyone else in my world, if Lynn doesn't like something or questions something mm-hmm. that I still haven't quite figured out for myself, it could set me back weeks. So I've learned, okay, I'm going to protect myself a little bit longer. And I remember when I had the first reading in New York of Sight Unseen, and my wife was there, and I sat in a place where I could see her reaction the entire time. And I have to say, it was one of the most pleasurable experiences of my creative life, is watching her discovery of this play.
Wow.
It was wonderful. Really, it was a tremendous gift. So yeah, so that's a very important aspect of being a creative person, with someone who is very smart, but not of the theater.
Yeah, but understands writing.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's
absolutely. And you know, in being a father, my God, that just changes everything. It really has. I mean, it changes sort of the logistics of one's day. You know, I suddenly became a 9-to-5 writer when my son was born, because that was our childcare
right.
window. And I'm married to a doctor, so her schedule was always crazy, and I was the house husband. And it was a very charmed existence for a long time. My son's out of the house now, so this is a new chapter we're experiencing. But the thing about having a child, and I could not have written Dinner with Friends without having had my son.
Really?
I don't think so, because the addition of children in the equation, I think, is so profound. Mm-hmm. It's so life-altering and world-perceiving.
And it raises the stakes.
It raises everything.
Yeah.
You know, Gabe has a speech in Dinner with Friends about, you know, how suddenly you're struck with thoughts of mortality. You know, theirs, yours, you know, airbags, plane crashes, you know, all of these things coalesce because you suddenly have this new human in the mix who's yours, that you are utterly responsible for. And it redefines everything in relation. That one addition, this person, this human that you've created, changes everything.
I was talking with a friend of mine today. I hope she doesn't mind that I steal her story, but I'll truncate it. But she shared with me the experience of her parents going to see Dinner with Friends, and she didn't know about it. And she asked them how it was, and they said, you should read it. And so they sent her a copy of the play, mm-hmm. and she read it, and she realized reading it that was her mother's way of telling her that her aunt and uncle were getting a divorce.
Oh, she understood that.
She understood it.
It was code for Aunt Mary is leaving Uncle John?
Yeah. And it was, anyway, they were very, very close family.
Right.
And the way that was communicated to her so clearly from her mother has stuck with her.
Mm-hmm.
But that sort of idea of, you know, how do you explain things to the kids?
Yeah.
You know, becoming aware of your mortality and even having your play about that on right. so many levels impact the people in the audience in a way that's saying, like, how am I going to tell my kids?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When the play first hit in New York 12 years ago, there was a young couple. It was like they were out on a date, you know, in their 20s, probably.
It's an interesting date.
Well, exactly. No, exactly. And I was curious, and I went up to them at intermission. No, it was at the end of the play. And I said, can I ask you a question? I said, I'm the playwright, and I'm just curious. Why are you here? No, seriously, because that is not the demographic in New York theater. So the fact that they were there, because they chose to be there, was very interesting. And the young woman said to me, I said to her, can you really even identify with this play? And she said, oh, God, this, now I know why my father left my mother.
Wow.
And I thought, yes! Yes, I understand. But I mean, that was extraordinary.
You know,
that was, what a gift that was. Like, my God, I hadn't thought of that.
Excellent. Any final thoughts, gentlemen?
No, but thank you so much.
This was delightful.
This was really fun. So thank you both of them.